This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new book, Just Another Soldier, is my guest Jason Christopher Hartley's journal of military life. He'd been a member of the National Guard for 13 years when he was called to active duty. He spent 2004 in Iraq's Sunni Triangle. His journal originated as a military blog, but shortly before he was sent to Iraq, he was told that his blog violated operational security and that he was smearing his unit and the army. His company commander asked him to take down the blog. Hartley complied. He continued to keep a journal and send out his entries as emails. With 2 months left to serve in Iraq, he decided to put up his blog again. This time he was punished with a demotion and a $1,000 fine. Currently, his blog, justanothersoldier.com, has photographs and deleted scenes from his book. Now, recently, the U.S. Army Chief of Staff, General Peter Schoonmaker, complained that some soldiers have posted sensitive information on their blogs, including, quote, photos depicting weapon system vulnerabilities and tactics, techniques, and procedures. And he also expressed his concern about protecting the Army's image both in the United States and in other countries, because he thought that some of these blogs were giving the Army a bad image. Do these sound legitimate complaints to you?
They are the closest to legitimate complaints anyone has made so far. Like he listed specifically, for example, as far as photographs go, to not post photographs of battle-damaged vehicles, like Humvees that have been hit by improvised explosive devices. There is some merit to that. For someone to know the kind, you know, how effective their attacks have been, that's one that I would even have to kind of think about. I mean, any photographs that I've had on my website that are similar to that, I've taken them down because of finally, he says that I'll take them down. And also the image one, that's a huge gray area as far as you're concerned. Yes, if you had every soldier putting up blogs saying how much they thought the war was unjustified, that could definitely erode what little support there might still be. You know, that's kind of a concern. But then it's like, well, where do these concerns end in, like, say, the First Amendment begin? I think his arguments are the most valid that anyone from the military has made so far about concerning blogs, but I don't think they're exactly watertight yet either.
Outside of the fact that writing the blog gave you a way to write and to express what you and the men around you were going through, what you were feeling, what did you get back from it? Did you get a lot of response to it?
I got quite a bit of response, and I think that was what really kept me doing it. It was so rewarding. Every time I would post a new story, I would get there'd be a lot of response back, and most of it positive. I would try to be as incendiary and as offensive as possible, just to try to get a rise out of somebody. And I really couldn't get it. People were so supportive, regardless of what I spoke about, and that really became the motivation to continue writing. It kept me sane, and it gave me a project, kept my mind active the entire time that I was in Iraq and not on missions.
You write about the first time you fired a grenade, and you were basically on what you describe as ambush duty, looking for people who might be driving down the road planting roadside bombs. How were you given the order to fire on this specific vehicle that we'll be talking about?
Well, in this case, I wasn't given an order. We were part of a very small team. We had 5 guys. This was something that we were just beginning to do while we were – it was a tactic. These ambushes were a strategy our commanders had come up with that was ended up being very effective. And this was one of the first engagements that we had as a result of these ambush operations. And we had a vehicle at the time we believed was definitely enemy. He was spotted planting 155-millimeter artillery rounds on the side of the road, which is the most common detonation charge in these improvised explosive devices guys put out. And he was fleeing, so we engaged the vehicle, and which included me. I expended about a magazine of rounds and a 40-millimeter grenade. Probably the most exciting thing, one of the most exciting moments of my life was actually being able to engage that vehicle, making a concerted effort to kill someone. Turns out later the guy was a civilian. He wasn't an insurgent at all. His vehicle was overheating. He was trying to find a bottle of water on the side of the road, which through night vision goggles and through thermal sights, the shape of the water bottle looks exactly like an artillery round. So at the time, the decision to engage the vehicle was a sound one. The first team that had fired on the vehicle was they intended to disable the vehicle. By the time the vehicle came to my location, we believed that we were engaging the vehicle to destroy it. So there was a small communication breakdown there. And in the end, the guy was wounded. He lived, thank God. But what made that particular engagement interesting was the fact that emotionally, I wanted nothing more than for that grenade to hit that bus and to see the thing explode and burn. Even after the fact, knowing that it was an innocent civilian who was in that vehicle, there's still a part of me that wishes the grenade would have hit the vehicle.
Does it disturb you that you feel that way?
You know, I intellectually, yes, it does disturb me. But honestly, emotionally, it doesn't disturb me. I don't really know why, but this is the thing that I'm trying to reconcile as well. There's, why would a part, even knowing the guy was innocent, why would I still on a visceral level want the thing to have exploded? You know, I don't have the answer to that question. I don't know.
You write a little bit about times when you had to oversee Iraqi prisoners in a jail on your base. And you say that you found yourself walking a fine line between proper Geneva Convention-esque humane treatment of enemy combatants and being made a fool of by the same guys who had been making fools of your unit for the past few weeks by hitting the base with almost nightly mortars. Can you talk a little bit about walking that line, about, you know, wanting to observe the Geneva Conventions, on the other hand, not wanting to be made a fool of or being taken advantage of by the people who were your prisoners?
Well, this was a duty that I think that we were very, as infantrymen, unprepared to do. Dealing with detainees is something that's military police. That's more their job. There are people who are trained to do this. They know, they kind of know what they're getting into. As a grunt, it's, you know, that was, we were kind of thrust into this situation where sometimes we'd have to pull duty on guarding the detainees. And I think that between not being prepared to deal with detainees, and also just by virtue of the fact that I was raised in a pretty authoritarian environment. I was raised in Utah as a Mormon. It's very patriarchal, you know, my upbringing. And discipline is something that I suppose is programmed in me on some really basic level, simply because of the way that I was raised. And having detainees in my mind, I'm thinking like, well, there should be a certain level of discipline. These guys shouldn't be goofing off. They shouldn't be making fun of me. I mean, I'm the guy with the gun, right? So when sometimes we would meet this kind of resistance with the guys that we had in our cells, it was, I felt like, well, you know, what do? Do I sacrifice? Should I allow myself to be humiliated by the guy who I'm supposed to be in charge of, or should I try to assert some kind of authority? And when I do assert my authority, how do I do that effectively? And I think in situations like that, at least for me personally, it's so easy to take things a little bit too far in an attempt to do things more correctly. And sometimes the feelings that I felt, you know, the things that I felt myself thinking in situations like this where I'm trying to deal with a really difficult detainee was very disturbing. And when you have that much power over someone, it's sometimes hard to deal with frustrating situations and still be humane.
One situation where you thought maybe you had taken it too far is when you were taping up a detainee's face with duct tape. Would you describe why you were doing that?
At the time, the policy that we had enough guys in the jail at the time that it was, whoever makes these decisions felt that it was important that these men remain blindfolded. So, okay, it's my job to make sure these, you know, these guys stay in their cells, that they their blindfolds remain on, and that they don't, there's not a whole lot of chit-chat. You know, the idea being to silence them, you don't want them sharing information or getting, like, their stories straight or whatever. But I had one guy who was particularly defiant, and he kept on, his blindfold kept on falling down, or he kept on figuring out a way to, like, get his blindfold down even though his hands were bound. So I took him out of his cell, I tied a really tight blindfold on, then he managed to pull that down with his teeth. So I felt like such a jerk. The soldiers that I'm working with, I'm being made a fool of by this guy. All the other detainees are looking at me like, you know, ha-ha, we got a guy here who's, like, making you look like a jerk. So I figured, you know, I'm not going to be made a fool in this situation, so I grabbed a bunch of duct tape and I gave him a duct tape blindfold, you know, which basically was like, okay, let me see you pull that down now, guy. Which, of course, you know, he couldn't. But it's just, in that situation, I didn't feel great about myself afterward. It's like, why am I dealing with this guy like this? Why am I, you know, compromising my own sense of humanity just to assert some kind of like baloney authority I'm supposed to have right now?
Were there other times when you felt you had to compromise your sense of what was right in order to assert your authority or, you know, maintain or regain control of a situation?
Well, there were a few times, and what's the irony of it, too, is the things that you usually find yourself doing to try to, you know, grapple, to try to gain control of a situation, ultimately, you're not gaining control of the situation. For an example, we were in this town of Dujail quite a bit, you know, performing various security missions, and which basically entailed us standing around a lot, just kind of like, you know, trying to not be attacked while somebody else did something, we were guarding them. There was one day when a couple of kids were in a truck, and there's no really age, driver's license age in Iraq. These kids, they couldn't have been more than 10 or 11, were driving a truck, and they thought it was funny to like drive right at us and then swerve at the last minute. Now, had that been an adult doing that, I probably would have shot them and felt fine about it. But in this case, I got two 10 or 11-year-olds. I can tell they're goofing off. They want to see, you know, if they can press the soldiers' buttons. And it worked. And it's like, well, what am I going to do? I'm not going to shoot these kids. I mean, technically, they're putting my life. They're definitely a threat. What if, you know, the kid doesn't swerve correctly at the last minute? Or what if he does want to kill me? I don't know. But the kids did this twice. The second time I actually, you know, I pointed my weapon at the kid. I'm like, you know, what am I going to do? Shoot the kid? Honestly, I'm probably not going to do it. So I'm trying to assert some kind of authority again in a situation that I can't get a handle on. And in the end, what do I feel like? Well, I feel like a jerk that I let some kids, you know, play me like that, basically. And then another part of me feels bad that, like, I pointed my rifle at a kid.
You write about how you were often surrounded by children, that, you know, a lot of the troops were often surrounded by children. Were there a lot of children who were walking that line between being mischievous and genuinely threatening?
Well, I think it's probably safe to assume that none of the kids were actually a threat, but they definitely knew how to walk that line. You know, these are kids who they grew up on the street. They were tougher than me. I hate to admit that, but they completely were. I mean, I grew up in the suburbs of Utah. I'm not a tough kid. I might know how to fight if you give me a rifle, but you know, I got in a staring contest with a kid one time and I lost. Why? These kids, they're tougher than me, and it's like, I'm like, damn it, this kid's 9. Why is he tougher than me? But sometimes they were, and they knew. And what are you going to do? Sometimes we could even get like a little bit physical with the kids, like grab their arm, or like, I even like threw small rocks at some kids one day. It's like, these things don't faze them. They're slapped around by their parents. I mean, the culture in Iraq is they're pretty physical with punishment. There's nothing that I can do to these kids that they don't already know how to endure to no end. And it became to try to remain tactical in an environment where you're dealing with 24 kids, you know, wanting like your sunglasses and candy and water and food, and you know, they want your latest issue of Maxim magazine or something, it became so difficult to remain professional in an environment where you were basically a babysitter for juvenile delinquents.
So what did you do? I mean, did you try to stay away from the kids? Was that possible?
There really was no solution. You basically try to pawn the kids off on somebody else. Maybe you have somebody new to the group who hasn't been in town many times, and this was their first time in town. Like, go bug that guy. He has tons of water. He got lots of candy. there really wasn't a solution. You just try the best. Like, well, I guess I'm going to have to become less tactical because these kids right now are winning. The Iraqi police, they were actually pretty good. These guys are cruel enough that if we really had troubles with kids, we just grab some of the IP guys, and they had no compunction about swatting the kids, and the kids were actually pretty afraid of them. But in most cases, we just put up with it. That's all we could do.
Now, you were raised in Salt Lake City. You were brought up Mormon. You spent time in a platoon in Utah where you say 99% of the platoon was white suburbanites. Then you moved to New York City and ended up in a unit that was largely Hispanic. You say you were one of two white members of your unit. How do you think ethnic differences affected, you know, friendship and cohesiveness within the units that you served in?
I'll tell you what, the Army is an incredibly integrated organization. I think that's probably one thing they can definitely be very proud of. But despite that integration, the cliques that guys hang out in are still always down racial lines, and just simply because it's the most – you hang out with people that you have the most common, you know, background with. And I've just sort of found – and I'm not trying to make any kind of, you know, judgment on things, but I have definitely found that it's the Hispanic soldiers who are the most enjoyable to be around, and the white soldiers tend to be really insecure and uptight and are less fun to be around. When I moved to this unit in Manhattan, it was all Puerto Ricans and Dominicans, and I didn't know the military could be so much fun. And so I happily reenlisted because these are the guys that I wanted to be with. And it was interesting is when we deployed to Iraq is we had to sort of smush two companies together, one that was primarily white and one that was my unit that was primarily Hispanic. And that was kind of a continual source of conflict within platoons, within the company, was problems that involved, you know, they didn't involve race directly, but they could be drawn down racial lines.
You're right. The chances of my personally capturing Osama bin Laden are slim, but I'd like to do something a little more than just simply being in the Army and sometimes sending money to the ACLU. Do you feel like the work you did in Iraq helped stop terrorism? Do you feel like the war in Iraq is helping to stop terrorism?
I want to give you a direct answer, so I'm going to say this. No, it's not helping it. It's a phenomenal training ground right now. If you're a terrorist or you're an aspiring terrorist and you want to learn how to fight a guerrilla war, go to Iraq. I mean, because it's an awesome place to do it right now. And all those people who are probably going to hate me for saying that, but as far as, you know, actual quantifiable results on this war on terror, what we're doing in Iraq, at this moment in time, today, it's not helping. Maybe 10 years from now, if we can, like, you know, start thinking constructively and creatively, it can be. If we can stabilize Iraq, set up shop over there, and maybe the Middle East will be less of a problem for us as far as a breeding ground for terrorists, and then, yeah, then the end will have justified the means, and the answer to that question will be yes, it was effective. But today, no, it's not.
So what did you do with that thought during the year when you were in Iraq risking your life? So you were doing this for a war against terrorism, but you felt that this was more contributing to terrorism, to training more terrorists, than it was preventing the spread of terrorism.
Well, I most definitely, absolutely did not have that thought while I was in Iraq.
You didn't?
I've been back for 9 months, and I've had a lot of time to kind of mull things over, and that's a conclusion that I've come to personally since I've been back, not while I was there. I've been staunchly apolitical my entire life, and it's because I hate the conundrum of these types of these arguments that seem to not really go anywhere. And I think, in my opinion, to be an effective, the most effective soldiers are ones who are able to divorce themselves from these ideas. I mean, the guys that we were fighting, they were fighting for a cause. I didn't want to fight for a cause. If anything, I fought for fighting's sake. I just like to fight. I'm a soldier, and my country, I believe, is a decent country, and I'm hoping that if it's going to go into combat, they're going to choose a good reason to do it. So I felt as though I'm relieved of a certain amount of moral decision-making. And then from there, I just wanted to do my job, do it well, and try and do it humanely. So, you know, these were not thoughts that I had while I was there, and I didn't want to have to worry about it. I was afraid that I might come to the realization that I have now, which is that it was a mistake to invade Iraq and that I could potentially be doing something completely wrong. If I was worrying about that kind of thing there, that could have seriously degraded my effectiveness as a soldier and therefore, you know, degrade my ability to defend myself and my friends.
When you did get home, some people would come up to you and say, "I don't support the war, but I support you." What was your reaction to hearing that?
I felt good about that. I felt it made me proud for them. It made me proud that today in America, you know, it's not like Vietnam. And soldiers talk about this a lot too. We always say to each other, you know, thank God this isn't Vietnam. We come home, people might say, "I think this war is garbage," but you're not. You don't represent the decisions of the administration. I respect you. I respect your service. But I disagree with this war. And I thought, you know, that's a person who has intellectual integrity, and a lot of respect for a person who might be doing a job that they wouldn't want to do. And every time, I know, I've never got tired of hearing that. It made me feel good.
You got into trouble for keeping a military blog. Are there military blogs now, or has everybody been forced to take them down?
No, there's probably more now than there ever have been, which is really kind of interesting. When I started my blog, there was only one other blog I was able to find that was by an infantryman, and it was really the guy was, you know, I'll give him credit. The guy was a grunt. He wasn't, his English skills weren't phenomenal. So I thought, oh, this is cool. Maybe I can actually, like, you know, blaze a new trail and you know write a blog from an infantryman's point of view that hasn't been done before. But now it's like there's, you know, every other guy carrying an M4 right now has a blog.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks, Terry.
Jason Christopher Hartley's new book is called Just Another Soldier. He's still a member of the Army National Guard in New York.